hppodcast.com.
Mr. Jonathan Chambers left his house on Maple Street at exactly 7 o'clock in the evening and set out on the daily walk he had taken at the same time, come rain or snow, for 20 solid years. The walk never varied. He paced 2 blocks down Maple Street, stopped at the Red Star Confectionery to buy a Rose Trefero Perfecto, then walked to the end of the 4th block on Maple. There, he turned right on Lexington, followed Lexington to Oak, down Oak, and so, by way of Lincoln, back to Maple again, and to his home. He didn't walk fast, he took his time. He always returned to his front door at exactly 7:45. No one ever stopped to talk with him. Even the man at Red Star Confectionery, where he bought his cigar, remained silent while the purchase was being made. Mr. Chambers merely tapped on the glass top of the counter with a coin. The man reached in and brought forth the box, and Mr. Chambers took his cigar. That was all.
And that concludes our coverage of The Street That Wasn't There by Clifford D. Simak and Carl Jacoby.
It's always sad when the whole story is over in the opening reading.
Yeah.
Such a bummer. I have to say, the description of that walk was really riveting, but was it weird? Of course, we were joking that was merely the first 3 paragraphs of this story. It does go to some weird places, however, kind of like you when you moved to England, and you met our reader today.
I did meet our reader.
Mr. John Hancock.
John is a treasure and a beautiful human being. God bless him.
John, he's an excellent reader. You can check him out on Twitter at Big Jack Brass. John is also available. He wanted me to let people know this. If you have a pyramid scheme you've just gotten involved with and you need to practice your pitch, John's your man. He loves that.
Oh, okay.
You don't even have to prepare him for it. Just ask him out to dinner or to a game and then boom, get out the presentation.
Oh, wow.
He'll be so happy you did that. He loves to hear pyramid scheme pitches. He likes it when someone's like, would you like to make $100 or more than $100? That's the kind of thing that appeals to
he loves
John.
It.
He loves it.
You really can't get enough of that.
Thank you, John, for reading. Good luck selling that case of gluten-free gothic cosmetics that I unloaded on you. Sucker. Speaking of suckers, this story was recommended by one of our patron supporters, Eric Danielson, who wrote in response to our show on Mimic. I have fond memories of this story from reading it as a child in the collection Creatures from Beyond, edited by Terry Carr. Most of the other stories are 1950s style creature features, but some have a good Lovecraftian vibe, especially The Street That Wasn't There by Clifford Simak. So thank you, Eric, for the recommendation. I really dug the story.
Yeah, me too.
Maybe we could have dinner sometime or something. There's an opportunity I'd like to talk to you about, but we don't have to get into that now.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this story.
This story was first published in 1941 in a magazine called The Comet. It's important to note that since this story actually takes place in 1960, it's a near future kind of story.
And I can't imagine that the future looked too bright in 1941.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Eric recommended the story, he said it was by Clifford Simak, but there are 2 authors listed. There's also this Carl Jacoby.
Yeah, our writing team, something we don't have much on the show, met each other in Minneapolis, Minnesota in 1939 when Simak moved there to work for The Star as a journalist. They were buds for a long time, but this is the only story they had published together.
I was poking around looking into the relationship between these guys, and I saw that Clifford Simak wrote a pretty fawning review of one of Carl Jacoby's books in 1964 in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. So they continue to help each other out.
Yeah.
But that was an Arkham House collection by Jacoby called Portraits in Moonlight. And Simak writes in the headline, macabre literature is done without shrill excitability. Do you think that was a common complaint at the time? You know? I'd read more macabre literature if it weren't for all that excitability. Especially the shrill kind. Can't stand it.
Simak was born in 1904 in Wisconsin. He worked as a journalist in the Midwest most of his life, but also made part of his living as a writer, writing for such publications as Astounding Stories, Astounding Science Fiction, and Marvel Tales. He worked with John W. Campbell during his leadership at Astounding Science Fiction, and he also wrote war and Western stories, as well as other pulp mags. He's also buds with Isaac Asimov. Poor Simak died in 1988.
Mm-hmm.
Carl Jacoby was born in 1908 in Minneapolis, and he lived there throughout his life. He went to college at University of Minnesota and wrote as a journalist. A good Lovecraftian connection, Jacoby went to college with Donald Wandry, and he met August Derleth in 1921 when Derleth was in town to visit Wandry. And then they stayed in touch, but they never really became good friends. He wrote a lot for Weird Tales, and Arkham House published his third collection. He died in 1997.
I believe that third collection was that Portraits in Moonlight book I was just talking about that Arkham House put out. And he was one of the last Pulp Fictioneers to have contributed to Weird Tales in its 20s and 30s heyday. But he did sell his stuff everywhere, Jacoby. Mm-hmm. Even though he had to work all sorts of odd jobs just to get through, he continued cranking out good fantasy, horror, and sci-fi his whole life. One of the stories he wrote back in the day was called Mive, M-I-V-E. It appeared in Weird Tales in 1932. And Lovecraft was a big fan of it. He actually wrote a letter to Jacoby praising it.
Oh.
Writes, Mive pleased me immensely, and I told Wright, that's Farnsworth Wright, the editor, that I was glad to see at least one story whose weirdness of incident was made convincing by adequate emotional preparation and suitably developed atmosphere.
Hmm.
So Lovecraft was a fan of Jacoby.
Yeah.
Clifford Simak is probably better known between the two of them, I think. At least he's more decorated.
Yeah.
He won 3 Hugo Awards and 1 Nebula Award. Also, the Horror Writers Association made him one of 3 inaugural winners of the Bram Stoker Award for Lifetime Achievement.
Yeah.
So a couple of powerhouses here. This is a team up.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when Derleth and Lovecraft's old discarded notes get together. You know it's going to be good.
This is nothing like that.
No, this is nothing like that. These guys are pros.
But let's get into the story. Our protagonist, Mr. Chambers, is a man who likes to be left alone and to walk exactly 45 minutes every night. During this walk, he would stop at a shop, the Red Star Confectionery, and buy a cigar. He wouldn't even talk to the guy that worked there. He just put his money on the counter. The guy gave him a cigar.
And Chambers is a fairly common name, so there might not be any significance to it, but I thought maybe it was a reference to Robert W. Chambers,
right?
Who was the author of The King in Yellow. And I can't confirm whether it was or not, but Jacoby's last published story in 1987 was called A Choir of Foolscap.
Mm-hmm.
Came out in the publication Whispers, and it contains an in-joke. An unfaithful wife and her lover check into a motel out on Carcosa, which was a reference to... That's an Ambrose Bierce creation initially, An Inhabitant of Carcosa, but also Chambers' King in Yellow. And then there was a publishing firm at the time that had just been established in the 80s by Carl Edward Wagner that was called Carcosa. So it was probably a reference to those things. I'm going to guess he was aware of Robert Chambers, or as aware of Robert Chambers as any of us are. So I'm guessing that maybe this is a little in joke. I don't know.
Yeah.
Certainly Chambers wrote a lot about urban horror.
This was adult film star Marilyn Chambers took her name from this story. That's a bit of an in joke.
Right?
Yeah. She was really into this particular story, recommended it to many people within the industry. So it kind of floated around a lot. And most people in the porn industry know that that's a little tip of the hat. So we find that Mr. Chambers used to be a professor of metaphysics, a philosophical position, at the university. He was somehow kicked out for being too revolutionary?
That's all you have to do to hook me. A professor who was fired for scandalous teachings?
Yeah.
That's awesome. I'm definitely going to be into this story. And maybe that did happen a lot in the 1940s. I don't know. But I went to University of Illinois. I worked at UCLA for quite some time. Whenever a professor made the news or was given the boot and it was something that people heard about, it was never because of their radical theories of metaphysics, you know? It was always because they were stealing or touching students or running some Nazi social media account on the download.
Yes.
I don't know. Maybe I was born in the wrong time. But Chambers has been doing this walk for 20 years. It's always the same. He is a man of habit. He doesn't deviate. Leaves at 7 p.m., home by 7:45, never changes. That's the way he likes it. And it seems that this obsessive compulsive adherence to routine started when he was expelled from university 20 years before. Since then, he's absolutely lived by the clock.
One night on his routine evening walk, he notes that one of the streetlights is out, but whatever. And he also feels like he got to an intersection a bit early for some reason, which is something that hasn't happened to him in the 20 years that he's done this walk. He walks on and notes that there's the dog that always barks at him. And he also notes there's a radio blaring down the street, and he can only make out bits of it. It says,
"Still taking place, Empire State Building disappeared. Thin air, famed scientist Dr. Edmund Harcourt."
And he thinks it's a radio play and references War of the Worlds, but he ignores it and moves on with his walk.
Yeah, it says he remembered a radio drama from many years ago, something about the Martians. Mm-hmm. So I think that's cool because I think a modern reader would still know what he's talking about.
Well, yeah.
He does seem to have some knowledge of this Dr. Harcourt that's mentioned. He was one of the men who laughed at him back when he was putting out whatever crazy theory he was putting out. So he's going to disregard whatever this news is about, even though somebody he knows was mentioned in it.
Yeah.
And he does write it off as one of those fantastic radio dramas, but if I were walking by that radio and I heard about the Empire State Building disappearing, I would just think that David Copperfield is at it again.
Oh, yeah.
Remember when he made the Statue of Liberty disappear?
You bet I do. That was televised on one of 3 networks, man. It was awesome.
It was a pretty cool trick, actually. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. I watched the special. I liked it.
Yeah.
I always wondered, with that much raw magical power, why he wastes it on doing things like that when he could be saving lives. And
Chan, you know that those are tricks, right?
I know other magicians do tricks, but this is David Copperfield. I mean, I saw him make the Statue of Liberty disappear. You know, he didn't palm it. That thing's way too big, so clearly he's got real you know, real magical power.
We'll talk after the show.
Sure.
Then Mr. Chambers comes across the men talking excitedly in front of a drugstore, saying stuff like, "It's happening everywhere. What do you think it is? The scientists can't explain." Again, he ignores this. Mr. Chambers has really cut himself off from the world as a matter of personal policy.
No, he had laid down a personal tenet 20 years before that he would let nothing, absolutely nothing in the world, upset him. This actually reminds me a little bit of an article I read in the New York Times a couple of months ago. There's this guy in Ohio who was so upset about the election of Trump that he decided, that's it, I'm going completely news deaf. I don't care what happens anymore. I'm not going to learn about anything that's happening in the world. Mm-hmm. He calls it a blockade, I think. But he's been at it for more than a year. He doesn't read the news. He lives on a farm that's pretty distant from everything. Mm-hmm. There's about an hour drive away. He'll go to this coffee place. But when he's there, he wears like white noise headphones. So he doesn't even hear people in conversation reference what's going on in the world. He's totally committed to not knowing anything about it. I'll link out to this article. It's pretty interesting.
That's crazy.
But his point of view was, I followed the news for years and I was always upset about it. But there's nothing I could do with that information I was taking in.
Well,
so what's the point? I'll probably be happier if I just don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
It's crazy, but he says he's happy since he's not had to go through anything that folks who follow the news have had to go through in the last year. So I'll link out to it. It's pretty interesting. But a lot like this guy.
Yeah, I could see that. He finishes his walk, arriving at his door, and then he looks at his pocket watch. He violently starts seeing that it is only 7:30. He is 15 minutes early, and that has never happened in 20 years. He also realizes he doesn't have a cigar. He didn't stop to buy one. He goes into his house and locks the door behind him. His place is small but quiet. He did once have a working radio, but he doesn't listen to it anymore, as per his cut off from the outside world thing.
Right.
Of course, he doesn't read the newspaper, and he doesn't leave his house any further than the walks that he does. That's as far away from his house as he goes, and the rest of his time he spends in the house.
Interesting writing here. It says he had stopped reading newspapers and magazines too, had exiled himself to a few city blocks, and as the years flowed by, that self-exile had become a prison, an intangible, impassable wall, bounded by four city blocks by three. Beyond them lay utter, unexplainable terror. Beyond them, he never went. Clearly, the character knows something. I mean, you might just think that he's mentally ill and afraid of the outside world and a little agoraphobic, but I'm guessing this is tied into whatever his research was about.
Sure.
And that's the reason that he won't go any further than that.
So he would occasionally hear things from the shouting newspaper boys or people talking in the streets. So now we find out about the future world of 1960. The wars in Europe and Asia had flamed to an end to be followed by a terrible plague, a plague that was even now sweeping through country after country like wildfire, decimating populations. A plague undoubtedly induced by hunger and privation and the miseries of war.
And again, in 1941, that probably didn't seem like an unlikely future.
Mm-hmm.
Don't pay attention to what that wacky Steven Spielberg movie says, 1941. It was a bad time. It wasn't just like fun with Dan Aykroyd. Nobody's seen that movie, by the way. That's a terrible reference.
I knew what you were talking about.
All right.
It was on HBO a lot when we were kids.
Yeah, but that was his first big flop. People didn't like it at all.
No, I think it was a bad movie. The world outside, of course, doesn't matter to him. What matters is that he was 15 minutes early and he doesn't have a cigar.
It's really confusing to him. He says he thinks, had his long exile finally turned his mind? Had he lost his sense of proportion, of perspective?
So he sits in his living room and he wonders if he's losing his mind, but he feels like he's not. He looks around and he sees his living room is just as it should be, focusing on a picture, a print of a painting of an old sailing ship on a placid sea with a vague larger ship far in the distance.
There's an elephant ashtray and a ticking grandfather clock. He has other prints in the room as well, but the image of the sailing ship, that painting is the one he likes to look at. And I think there's some significance to that, but we'll look back at it later.
Yeah. He goes to bed, but he lies awake with vague fears he can neither define nor understand. And man, I've been there.
Sure.
He has a nightmare that he's on an island in the middle of the ocean and that sea snakes are eating away at this island. And then he has another nightmare where he's running from something that he can't see or hear. But when he's running, he's not moving any place. He's like stuck and his legs are pumping, but he can't get any traction. And again, I've had that dream too.
Moonwalking in place.
Yeah, he tries to scream, but he can't. He's unable to scream. And that ends his dreams.
Again, we have this imagery of the ocean where the sea snakes are devouring the island he's on. And I think all of this plays into the story's central concept.
So the next day, he stays home until 7 o'clock when he goes out for his walk, and he reminds himself not to forget the cigar. And as he walks, he feels he's going a bit faster than normal, but he comes to Grant Street, which means he passed the shop again.
Right.
So for the first time in 20 years, he walks back to retrace his steps, but then he gets to Marshall. The shop is supposed to be between Marshall and Grant. He stood astounded while a single incredible fact grew slowly in his brain. There wasn't any confectionery. The block from Marshall to Grant had disappeared. Now he understands why he missed it before and why he was early. He stumbles home in a horrified stupor.
That's great. An entire block just missing.
Yeah.
It's very dreamlike as well. I don't know if you've ever had dreams where places that are far away from each other are suddenly close.
Oh, yeah.
Like space folded or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've always been interested, since I've heard about it, in the many worlds interpretation, that all realities are possible and that they all exist.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these realities would just have subtle differences from our own, but almost everything else would be the same.
Right.
And I always imagine, like, what if you slipped from one reality to another? Would you even notice? You know, a house on your street is painted a different color.
Yeah.
Maybe a shop isn't there anymore.
Right.
Heather has a goatee.
Yeah.
You know, just like little things that you wouldn't pick up on. You'd probably explain all of those things away.
Yeah.
It would take a while for you to think, I slipped into another dimension.
Chad, the show Rick and Morty goes deep into this idea.
Yes, of course it does. It does a great job of it, too.
A really good job of it. Everybody should watch Rick and Morty. It is a really good show. It's like solid sci-fi on top of just being really funny.
Yeah, it is. I mean, people all the time write in, have you seen this? Because there, you know, there's a big Cthulhu right in the beginning of the of the show. Oh, yeah, I'm a big fan. It took me a while to click into it, actually. I was a little late to the party, but I've seen every episode multiple times now.
Yeah, it's a brilliant show. Everybody should watch it. Everybody, even if you don't like science fiction, it'll change your mind.
Yeah. I also liked this description in the story. It says, on legs that were dead things, he stumbled back to his home.
Yeah,
the writing is really good.
It is good.
I love all the imagery.
So he feels cold in his house and he starts a fire. The silence that he liked before is now different. It says, not a homey, comfortable silence, but a silence that hinted at emptiness and nothingness.
By what inconceivable necromancy could a paved street with houses, trees, and buildings be spirited away and the space it had occupied be closed up? It's really horrifying. And I also just wanted to quickly point out that Inconceivable Necromancy is the name of a really great gluten-free smoky mascara that I've got. And Chris, since I've got you on Skype here, as well, the folks at home listening.
Sure.
This is an opportunity you're going to want to hear more about.
Okay, great.
If you want to have a gluten-free goth lifestyle, I'm just saying there's solutions out there.
Okay, great. That's good. After the war, there were plagues. Millions, if not billions of people all over the world have died. But that's not the answer. He doesn't have enough to piece everything together. So Mr. Chambers goes and he looks out the window and he sees the moonlit sky, notices that the house across the street is different.
Yeah, the authors play well with all of the senses in the story, too. They mention here and there that his pendulum clock keeps ticking and chiming, setting up a sympathetic vibration with a nearby vase. Anyway, he goes to look at this house.
The house is twisted in some way. It's at strange angles, but then it fixes itself and is back to normal.
Yeah, almost like once he thought about how the house should be, the house then became that way.
He looks away in relief, but then when he looks back, it's warped again. He goes to his room, he takes some sleeping powder, and he goes to bed. He has those nightmares again about the island and the snakes. When he wakes up in the morning, he looks out the window and he sees nothing, as if there's a thick fog outside, and he could barely make out the apple tree in the yard. Once he does, though, he knows that the tree wasn't there when he first looked.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, he's able to make out outlines of houses, but they're all wrong. Not the right houses, not quite the right shapes. He sits and tries to figure out what to do. And he has an idea. He runs to his bookshelf, and there is a book that is very important to him. It changed his life. It's the book that he wrote 20 years ago and attempted to teach at the university that people didn't like. He says, narrow-minded townsfolk failing to understand either his philosophy or his aim, but seeing in him another exponent of some anti-rational cult, had forced his expulsion from the school.
This is the mad theory that we're about to hear.
Yes. So he reads over some of the sections.
Man himself, by the power of mass suggestion, holds the physical fate of this earth. Yes, even the universe. Billions of minds, seeing trees as trees, houses as houses, streets as streets, and not as something else. Minds that see things as they are and have kept things as they were. Destroy those minds, and the entire foundation of matter, robbed of its regenerative power, will crumple and slip away like a column of sand. Yet this would have nothing to do with matter itself, but only with matter's form. May we not go farther and envision other minds in some other plane, watching us, waiting craftily for the time they can take over the domination of matter? Such a concept is not impossible. It is a natural conclusion if we accept the double hypothesis, that mind does control the formation of all matter, and that other worlds lie in juxtaposition with ours. Perhaps we shall come upon a day far distant when our plane, our world, will dissolve beneath our feet and before our eyes as some stronger intelligence reaches out from the dimensional shadows of the very space we live in, and wrests from us the matter which we know to be our own.
So I think what he's saying is that the minds of humanity, of people, make reality. They keep it in check.
The matter of reality is going to exist no matter what. It can't be created or destroyed, but it's our collective perceptions that shape it.
Right. Very Mage of the Ascension. Yeah, role-playing game. And with so many deaths, so few people, there aren't enough minds to keep reality strong. So some outside force is able to move into our world and change things around.
Pretty interesting stuff. I mean, I don't see how this would get you kicked off of a college campus. I think I had 20 discussions in my first year at college where like, what if the color blue I see isn't the same color blue that you see, man? I mean, these kinds of perspective conversations seemed, at least in my experience, to be happening all the time. So he must have gone to a particularly conservative school. Must have taught there. I don't know.
Or he was just, it wasn't opinion to him. It was a matter of fact, and he was trying to teach it as fact.
Yeah, that might be a problem, too. I mean, if this is just postulation, that's great. But if you're going, this is the way it is, and this is what's going to happen, then at some point you have to kind of, yeah, cut the cord. Like, come on, buddy. We brought you here to teach biology or metaphysics or whatever. You can't just make stuff up
and
say, you know, and say it's real. I do think that his theories are what all the nautical stuff is about in the painting and in the dreams. Mm-hmm. Like, the ocean represents that instability of reality. It's constantly shifting and changing.
Yeah.
And in the painting, there's a ship that's making its way over the water, but another ship looms in the background.
Right.
And they're both kind of fighting over that space. Also in his dream about the sea serpents, the serpents are devouring the island that he's stuck on.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like this twofold concept that he's foreshadowing, both that reality is as malleable as water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'll take the shape of its container, the container being our minds and perception. Yeah. But also, there are things out there waiting for their chance to be the container.
Right.
Their chance to define it.
Yeah.
So I think that's what all that dreaming and hinting at is.
To me, I got that same thing from it as well. I thought for sure that the ship was him on that sea, and then that there was that other ship in the distance, that vague ship.
Yeah.
Kind of menacing, was lurking back there. And it was kind of a portent of what was to come.
Totally.
So since he's out of touch, he doesn't really know any more than this. His conjecture, really. So Chambers decides to go outside. The sky has no sun, only this fog-like gray, but it's not fog, it's emptiness. And he sees little when he gets outside, but when he gets closer to things, they come into view. Visibility extended only a few feet, and as he approached them, the houses materialized like two-dimensional pictures without perspective, like twisted cardboard soldiers lining up for review on a misty morning.
That's so cool.
Really good writing in this. So behind him, this grayness closes in, and Chambers yells to anyone who might hear him, but the sound of his voice sounds as if a giant door had been opened to a mighty room high above him. Finally, he gets to a place where the fog is so dense he can't see anything in it. So he screams and he runs.
And he manages to get back to his own home. Thankfully, it's still there.
He feels something behind him or some presence or something. So he looks and he sees that there's an alien landscape that's kind of silhouetted. It's totally different than what he's seen before.
Mm.
It was a city fantastic with cubed domes, spires, and aerial bridges and flying buttresses. Tunnel-like streets, flanked on either side by shiny metallic ramps and runways, stretch endlessly to the vanishing point. Great shafts of multicolored light probed huge streamers and ellipses above the higher levels.
And beyond, like a final backdrop, rose a titanic wall. It was from that wall that Mr. Chambers felt the eyes peering at him.
He thinks, or he feels, eyes are looking at him. Thousands of eyes glaring down, but with a single purpose.
And then he sees a colossal face, a face of indescribable power and evil, staring down with malevolent composure.
Mm-hmm.
So there's actually, whoever's reshaping all this reality is looking at him.
It's a one conscious will. It's not a people or a civilization. It's like a Thanos. But then this face fades out of focus and it's gone into the gray. Chambers goes into his house, but he doesn't lock the door behind him. There's no need.
I was a little confused at first. Is he just seeing the regular city that should be there? But it was definitely an alien cityscape that this thing is creating.
He uses all these strange things like cubed domes.
Right.
And
right.
Tunnel-like streets.
Yeah, that doesn't even make any sense.
Yeah, a lot of those things don't. I think it's sort of like a non-Euclidean vision. So he's trying to explain it by, you know, having these things that are juxtaposed.
Oh, man, Lovecraft would have gone nuts for this story. It's too bad he wasn't around.
Mr. Chambers sits in his chair without taking his coat off. Everything in his home seems to still be in place. There's the boat picture, and it does give him comfort. There are certain pictures, paintings, especially those old boat paintings, that I actually find some comfort from.
Really?
Yeah, there's just something calm about them. Like, it'd take you to another place, away from all your worries.
When you're angry, is that how I soothe you? Just like without a... Somebody run into a coffee house and see if you can find a motel, anything. There's got to be a boat picture somewhere. We got to get this guy calmed down.
If you're a friend of mine, you know to carry a picture of a boat.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chambers wonders how long he's going to be able to keep the gray away. He hopes that he can keep this place safe, and he walks over to his bookshelf. However, he realizes that some of his less read books are gone. It seems that the things not as firm in his mind will fade away first. He tries to think of them again with the hopes of bringing them back, but nothing. And then he notices the lamp on the table seems to be fading away. Like, right as he's looking at it, it's going. And then he focuses in on it, and then it comes back into solid form.
The rule seems to be the more fixed something is in your mind, the better you're able to manifest it in the real world or have control over that matter.
He starts to wonder if perhaps he's going mad, but he knows he's not. He knew something like this was going to happen, and everyone said he was crazy.
There's a great line that says, somewhere else the children might be playing on a street, but it would be a different street, and the children undoubtedly would be different too. For the matter of which the street and everything upon it had been formed would now be cast in a different mold, stolen by different minds, in a different dimension. That to me was interesting because it mentions that, you know, other people are going to be involved too. Like, we'll all get reshaped.
Right.
Those of us that are left, because this plague has devastated most of Europe, and there's just not enough humanity to hold the whole illusion together. We are part of that matter too, and the remaining people are going to get turned into some other kind of thing. That's pretty creepy.
It did make me wonder, though, about in the old days, when there were far less people in the world, mm-hmm. Why wasn't it a problem then?
They were just stronger.
I don't know.
That's a good, yeah, no, it's a good question. Well, maybe.
Just a thought I had.
Maybe reality was crazier then.
Yeah.
Maybe that's where a lot of our legends come from, because there weren't enough people to protect against these ultra-dimensional entities who were controlling things, and that's why they had magic and why you had
gods
and orcs and dwarves and all kinds of things that we now mythologize.
I like that. That's good, Pfeiffer. All right.
Yeah.
Chambers wonders if the war, the disease, if it was all part of some entity's plan.
Uh-huh.
Something humans fell into. Somehow they were able to manipulate events and make everybody die off.
Right.
And then be able to come in and get power. This thought upsets him, so he runs into his bedroom, but his bedroom's gone. And then he looks into the hall, and the hall's gone too. He goes back to his chair and sits, and he says, so here I am. Because, you know, what else is he going to do? That's it. That's all he's got. And he wonders if there are other people like him fighting for the last bits of reality. The street is now totally gone. The rest of the house is gone as well. Only this room remains, and it would stay the longest.
Yeah, he's got a bit of an advantage here, because since he's been reclusive and agoraphobic, he knows this room really well. So he's got control over these immediate surroundings.
He knows it's fading. I mean, the lamp was going, some of his books are missing, so he's got a tenuous hold at best.
Yeah.
He looks out the window, and he sees the alien city in the face, evil and cosmic. The room is starting to fade. His elephant ashtray is now gone. He says, oh, well, I never did like that very well. He wondered if the ashtray was in another dimension. If so, what did it look like? Did it change to fit the new world? Would he change? Or will he just be gone?
He wondered if he would retain his individuality, if he still would be a person, or would he merely be a thing? There was one answer to all of that. He simply didn't know. Nothingness advanced upon him, ate its way across the room, stalking him as he sat in the chair underneath the lamp, and he waited for it. The room, or what was left of it, plunged into dreadful silence. Mr. Chambers started. The clock had stopped. Funny. First time in 20 years. He leapt from his chair and then sat down again. The clock hadn't stopped. It wasn't there. There was a tingling sensation in his feet.
That's the end.
That's the end.
Great story.
Yeah.
So he, you know, he's going in the end there, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not just some kind of neuropathy or something.
No, I get the impression that he is being manipulated and changed. His matter is being taken away and becoming something else.
This touches on something that we talked about with the vegetable man, where, you know, he says, will I still be a person? Will I just be a thing? There's one answer to all of that. He simply didn't know.
Yeah.
It's that I'm crossing over into something else and I don't know how it's going
to
be.
It's also, I found this depressing as well, the story. It just, to me, seemed to be just a story about getting older and dying. That there's this inevitability as you get older that things are going to start slipping away and you're going to have less control over things and eventually you're going to go too.
I think you're right. I was pretty surface level with this, so I didn't really think about that, but I think it's an excellent metaphor for just time passing, you know?
Yeah.
How if you're used to surroundings and year over year, that building's not there anymore and this is different now. And
exactly.
This doesn't work the way that it used to. And I feel like I'm pretty savvy, but I feel like sometimes things are moving a little too fast. You know, I'm confused at the grocery store because now I got to put the cart in this way instead of that way. Or, you know, there's always, there's just this inevitability of change. And then also mentally, you decay a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Did I put those keys there or are they in my pocket? You know, those things start to happen. And then eventually you get a tingling sensation in your feet.
Yep.
Yeah. I didn't really think too much about that. I was just really the concepts were so cool. I was kind of more thrilled by that. But you're definitely right. I think that that's there. I've always been fascinated with these kind of what is reality stories. It put me in mind of this Twilight Zone episode from the 80s when there was the 1980s Twilight Zone. It was called A Matter of Minutes. And it was a thing where basically these people discover that every minute of reality has been constructed. They either get left behind or they move forward. I don't remember. Mm-hmm. But it's like totally blank and then they build reality. And then if you're there too long. Stephen King did something very similar with The Langoliers.
Okay.
Which is a good novelette. Also a pretty hilarious miniseries in that it's like really early computer effects.
Yeah.
So when the monsters come to destroy reality, they're these giant metal Pac-Mans that look very funny. But anyway, so real quick, when I looked up A Matter of Minutes, I was trying to see if I remembered what this was. It's actually based on a story called Yesterday Was Monday by Theodore Sturgeon. From 1941, same year as this. So I thought that might be an excellent follow-up, another 1941 story on the nature of reality. So I'm going to try and find it online somewhere. I'm sure it's around.
You know, I want to thank some of our new patrons. I'm so glad you guys are joining our team and making us keep going.
Yeah, we forgot last week to mention names at the end of the show.
Right.
To my eternal shame. That's ridiculous. Yeah. These people are working hard to keep this show going. So let's do it now.
Dead Zone the Podcast.
Want to thank Dead Zone the Podcast. Want to thank Brian Ramsey.
I want to thank Allison Scott.
Andrew McNeil. Thank you.
Robbie Roulette.
Also, we've got a patron that just goes by Gary.
Gary.
That's a mysterious name.
Kevin Smith.
Thank you, Kevin Smith. And also J.R. Puntel.
William Lohman.
Wow. Gave up being a salesman finally to support us. Thank you.
Never heard that one before.
I'm sure never. I try not to make those jokes, you know. William Lohman. That's impossible. Merlin Evers. I want to thank you.
Yes. Robert Harwood. You are awesome. Thank you so much.
And Dan Barber. Thank you so much for supporting us on Patreon. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in on Patreon. We really appreciate it. So far, so good. We're going to continue to get better at these new shows that we're doing. We're going to continue to try and find ways to add more content. But so far, it's going along pretty good.
We're learning as we go. We're kind of trying out new things, experimenting phase.
That's right.
Just like college.
I want to thank John Hancock for being an excellent reader, as always.
John, you are magnificent. Thanks for listening to all those pitches I gave you, man.
You've been in that situation before, though, haven't you?
I have. I've had a friend that I've lost touch with for a bit. They call me out of the blue to hang out. I go over to hang out. Boom, it's a pyramid scheme.
And that's where we're going to leave you for this week. Tune in next week when we will talk about the Theodore Sturgeon story, Yesterday Was Monday. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the HP Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.